thereafter.
Amen.
Inam.
Inam.
To the child.
To the child.
Astout.
Astout.
Offered prayers.
Offered prayers.
Avadarya.
Avadarya.
Understanding surely that the child was the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Purusham.
Purusham.
The Supreme
Person.
The Supreme Person.
Param.
Param.
Transcendental.
Transcendental.
Nata Anga.
Nata Anga.
Falling down.
Falling down.
Kritadi.
Kritadi.
With concentrated attention.
With concentrated attention.
Krita Anjali.
Krita Anjali.
With folded hands.
With folded hands.
Svarochisha.
Svarochisha.
By the brilliance of his personal beauty.
By the brilliance of his personal beauty.
Bharata.
Bharata.
O Maharaj Parikshit. Descendant of Maharaj Bharata. Sutika Griham. The place where the Lord was born. Virochayantam.
Illuminating all around.
Gatabi.
All his fear disappeared.
Prabhavavit. He could now understand the influence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Translation. O Maharaj Parikshit, descendant of King Bharata, Vasudeva could understand that this child was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan. Having concluded this without a doubt, he became fearless. Bowing down with folded hands and concentrating his attention, he began to offer prayers to the child, who illuminated his birthplace by his natural influence. Please repeat. O Maharaj Parikshit, descendant of King Bharata.
O Maharaj Parikshit, descendant of King Bharata.
Vasudeva could understand that this child was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan.
Vasudeva could understand that this child was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan.
Having concluded this without a doubt, he became fearless. Bowing down with folded hands, and concentrating his attention, he began to offer prayers to the child, who illuminated his birthplace by his natural influence. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Struck with such great wonder, Vasudeva now concentrated his attention on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Understanding the influence of the Supreme Lord, he was surely fearless, since he understood that the Lord had appeared to give him protection. Gatabi Prabhavavit. Understanding that the Supreme Personality of Godhead was present, he appropriately offered prayers as follows. Omangyana Timarandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militanina Tasma Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitanya Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam. So the translation again. O Maharaj Parikshit, descendant of King Bharata, Vasudeva could understand that this child was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan. Having concluded this without a doubt, he became fearless. Bowing down with folded hands and concentrating his attention, he began to offer prayers to the child, who illuminated his birthplace by his natural influence. So Krishna has now made his appearance before Vasudeva and Devaki, and Vasudeva was immediately relieved of his fear of Kamsa, because he recognized that this was actually the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who had personally appeared before him. So he then begins to pray to the Lord, and as one typically finds in these prayers made by the great devotees and sages, these prayers typically begin with a description of the transcendental position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because there's always the danger that one can mistake the Supreme Personality of Godhead when he appears in in the material world as some kind of material personality. And of course, there are various different schools of thought which claim this in various ways. There are the out-and-out atheists, or mudhas, who simply have an extremely dull intellect. And to them, even if they actually saw an incarnation of the Supreme Lord, they wouldn't have any idea what they were seeing. They would just take that as an ordinary human being. And then there are those who are Asuram Bhavam Ashritam, who have a definite desire to deny the existence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And they exert their efforts to devise atheistic philosophies in order to annihilate the Supreme Lord. They're unable to annihilate God through their physical prowess by somehow going out and destroying him. So they try to kill God by philosophy. And so this is very prevalent within the material world. Actually, there have occasionally been individuals who aspired to kill God physically. One of these was, there was Hiranyaksha in Hiranyakasipu, who actually felt that they had sufficient prowess to do this. But generally the idea is to destroy God by philosophy. And these philosophical speculations begin with the idea that everything that can be perceived must be material by nature. So if some personality appears within the material world, then this also must be a material manifestation. So people will try and argue that when Krishna appeared, or when Lord Ramachandra appeared, and so on, these somehow were material manifestations. Now, of course, in the West, the tendency will be to say that these were just ordinary human beings who were deified, just as the Roman emperors used to be deified. Different Roman emperors would pass decrees saying that they had to be worshipped as God. For example, Nero was worshipped as God and so forth. And apparently this was quite common in the ancient Mediterranean region. So the scholars will say that, well, a similar thing happened in India, and these were just ordinary human beings. Then there are the philosophers such as Shankaracharya and his followers, who will give a much more sophisticated analysis. These philosophers actually recognize the extraordinary powers that were exhibited by Krishna and other incarnations. And so they don't try to say that these personalities were just ordinary human beings. But they will argue that, for example, Krishna is a manifestation of the material mode of goodness in a pure form. But still, this is a material manifestation. So they will try to argue in this way. So for this reason, all the great devotees and great sages and so on, when they pray to the Lord, you'll see that practically always they begin by presenting an analysis of the actual position of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this essentially is done to counteract the propaganda of the atheists, because this propaganda is so widespread and so extensive that the devotees of the Lord are always having to fight against it. So even though a devotee may have a very actually intimate relationship with the Supreme Lord on the level of transcendental rasa, still you'll find that the devotees are always spelling out these elementary points concerning the nature of the Lord. So in this verse today, I was reminded of a another verse in the Bhagavatam that I was reading recently, because the word svarochisha is used here to to refer to the effulgence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it said that Krishna actually was lighting up the room by his presence. So this was translated here as the brilliance of his personal beauty. So the other day I gave a class on the Brahmajyoti, and various devotees had some questions about that. So, let's see, I can find this here. I thought that I would expand a little bit further on that. It's interesting that I just located this. But now, So, in this is in the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. What's happening here is that Narada Muni took birth from Lord Brahma as one of his mental sons. Lord Brahma actually has the power to manifest a complete living being from his mind. This gives some ideas to the nature of the mind. We can visualize things within our minds, but the images remain simply insubstantial. And if we actually want to manifest something in physical form, we have to start moving matter around with our hands. It's the only way we can do it. But Brahma's mind was so powerful that he could actually generate forms by thinking of them. And you can just imagine how dangerous that would be if we were endowed with that ability. You know, we'd be manifesting all kinds of horrendous things all the time. Actually, Brahma himself occasionally was somewhat perplexed by the power of his own mind. For example, once he was gazing into a pond at his own reflection, and he was beginning to sort of admire himself. And so, as soon as he did this, immediately from his mind there manifested a whole category of demigods called Kinnaras, who were specifically endowed with musical ability so that they could glorify Lord Brahma. And they immediately began composing songs and singing them so as to glorify Brahma. So, Brahma had created various mental sons. Actually, these creations were a manifestation through Brahma of the power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Brahma himself didn't understand how it was happening. And this is described in various places. Initially, when he first awoke to consciousness within the material universe, he found himself within a vast, empty space filled with darkness, sitting on this lotus flower. And initially, he recognized, just by intuition, that he had the role of creator within the material universe. However, he didn't know how to go about it. And it's described that initially Brahma engaged in empiric investigation to try and figure out his situation. So he recognized that he was sitting on this lotus flower and that that was his origin, and that that in turn must have originated from something else because it had a stem which was going somewhere. So he tried to follow the stem, and he was unable to trace out the origin of that stem. And this is interesting, by the way, because we will see pictures in the Bhagavatam in which it's very clear where the stem is coming from. Because there's the lotus flower, and there's the stem emerging from the navel of Garbhodakshai Vishnu. So it seems pretty clear. So one might ask why Brahma was having trouble understanding where the stem came from. So it seems that these paintings are being made by Krishna's mercy for our enlightenment. But actually, even the senses of Brahma were not sufficient to reveal Garbhodakshai Vishnu. So this shows that, you see, when we look at one of those paintings, we may tend to think, well, all these different elements of the picture are there, one above the other. There's the lotus flower and the stem, and then there's Garbhodakshai Vishnu and Sheshanaga. So why couldn't Brahma see it?
But it seems that it's not quite as simple as that. There are different levels of, you might say, different dimensions or different planes of reality within the total manifestation of the universe. And personalities who are equipped with different sensory powers are able to see different things. So Lord Brahma has very powerful senses, and he was able to see this lotus flower and the stem and so forth. But his senses were not so powerful that he could perceive the form of Garbhodakshai Vishnu. Garbhodakshai Vishnu was inaccessible to him. So this is something we should consider if we're ever bewildered by some of the statements in the Srimad Bhagavatam, because there are many descriptions of things that we don't see. For example, it's described in the Srimad Bhagavatam that there's a mountain 800,000 miles high, situated within this vicinity somewhere. So that's fairly large. You'd think it would be quite conspicuous. But we don't see it. In fact, we have no idea how we would go about seeing such a thing. But we should consider that, after all, Lord Brahma couldn't see Garbhodakshai Vishnu either. So this Narada Muni had taken birth from Lord Brahma as his son. So in a previous life, Narada Muni had acquired perfection as a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually, the story behind that is that in a still earlier life, Narada Muni had been a Gandharva. What was his name? No, I don't think. I come up with something like Upabharana. I'm not sure. But in any case, he was a Gandharva living within the heavenly planets. So the Gandharvas are extremely musical by nature, but they tend to be sort of heavenly playboys. So this particular Gandharva had sort of become involved in the association of women. He was extremely beautiful and had a great singing voice. And so he was accustomed to singing songs in the company of various women who were his great admirers. And so in this way he would enjoy himself. So it's described that at one point the Prajapatis, or rulers of the demigods, had arranged for the Sankirtan of the holy name of the Lord to take place there in the heavenly planets. It's interesting, this takes place there also. So people were singing, glorifying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this Narada, well, he wasn't Narada yet, this personality began singing songs glorifying the heroic exploits of the demigods in a somewhat intoxicated state, surrounded by various female admirers. So the demigods who were conducting the Hari Kirtan became somewhat offended, and so they cursed him that he would have to take birth as a Sudra. And so, sure enough, he took birth as a Sudra. He was the son of a maidservant, and his father was nowhere to be seen. Perhaps his father had died or gone off or something like that. But he acquired the association of some Bhaktivedantas, some great devotees of the Lord, who were being served by this woman who was acting as a maidservant. So in the course of associating with these great sages, this young boy was able to perform some service for them, and it's described that he also was able to partake of the remnants of their food. And so the seed of devotional service was actually planted in his heart. And later on, these sages departed, and also his mother was killed by snake bite, and he found himself a homeless orphan. But at this point, due to the influence of these great sages, he was able to renounce all material ambitions, and he began to travel about seeking spiritual development. So he became a wandering mendicant, and he was practicing meditation on the Lord within the heart. And eventually he acquired perfection in this meditation. So in his next life, he took birth as the son of Brahma, and that was nearly 2 billion years ago. So it gives you the idea of the time scale that we're talking about here. So he was had in his previous life become a devotee, but in this life, of course, initially he was in a somewhat bewildered state, having just become manifest. He knew that Brahma was his father, and he had observed the activities of Brahma. So he began to inquire from him as to the nature of the absolute truth. And actually, he approached Brahma in a very diplomatic way, saying that it was clear that Brahma was the creator of this material universe. And he could certainly see that Brahma had manifested very great powers in this regard. But still, he wondered whether or not there was something higher than Brahma, because he could observe that Brahma engaged in meditation. So if he engaged in meditation, then that indicated there must be something higher than him. So Brahma answered him that, in fact, there is someone higher than me, namely Krishna. And he began to describe Krishna to Narada Muni. So he was saying here to Narada Muni that I create after the Lord's creation by his personal effulgence, known as the Brahmajyoti, just as when the sun manifests its fire, the moon, the firmament, the influential planets, and the twinkling stars also manifest their brightness. So this was one of Brahma's statements, which is what I'd referred to before. So the interesting thing is that this word svarochisha is used here for the effulgence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's the same word that is used in this verse we read today. So, Srila Prabhupada points out in the purport that this svarochisha is referring to the Brahmajyoti, which is the effulgence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, what is being stated here is that Krishna potentially creates everything by the power of this Brahmajyoti, or Svarochisha, his personal effulgence. Sva here means his own. In general, this word sva, as in svayam, meaning his and so forth, it means his own. So it's a personal reference. This is not a reference to something impersonal. So it said that Krishna potentially creates through this personal effulgence. So the idea is that through this agency, everything is set up in a potential form so that it can then manifest. Actually, in the philosophy of Aristotle, this idea of potentiality versus actuality was a very prominent feature. Aristotle had the idea that an object is endowed with certain potentialities, so that's part of the reality of that object, even though those things are not manifest. And then an object will begin to manifest its particular potential, and thus things will gradually take place. So that's one aspect of the creation of the material universe, that Krishna first sets things up on a potential level, and then the actual physical manifestation takes place. So in the creation, it's described that there are two phases called sarga and visarga. So in the sarga phase of creation, the different elements and so forth are manifested on a potential level. And also the different senses, sense organs, and so forth are created. It's described that all of these things are created before Brahma actually appears. That is, before the lotus flower becomes manifested and Brahma emerges from it and so forth. So, for example, there's a description in the second and third canto that first from Mahavishnu and then Garbhadakshai Vishnu and then finally Kshiradakshai Vishnu, there's the manifestation of the universal form of the Lord, or Virat Purusha. And as this universal form manifests within each material universe, different senses and sense organs become manifest. But there are no living beings yet. So you might ask then, well, how is it that these different sense organs are becoming manifest if there are no living beings there to have those senses? But it's actually described that what happens is that there are the senses, the objects of perception, and the different material elements. And all of these are related together in an integrated way. So there's the description in Bhagavad Gita of Krishna's eight separated elements. And of these, there are three subtle elements, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And then four gross elements, which are described as earth, air, fire, water, and ether. So, in reading this kind of description, one might first get the impression that the Bhagavatam represents a primitive stage in the history of human civilization. Because here they're saying that the elements are earth, air, fire, and water. And after all, that's what the ancient Greeks believed. In fact, Aristotle taught that the elements were earth, air, fire, water, and ether. And this was taught by the Arabs and Muslims in the Middle Ages. And then finally, this knowledge was again returned to Europe through Spain and so forth via the Arabs. And the Europeans again began to believe in earth, air, fire, and water. But then with the scientific revolution, they realized that that was completely bogus. And they now know about the periodic table of the elements and the composition of the atom in terms of protons and electrons and neutrons and so forth. And they've gone on to quarks endowed with strangeness, color, and other interesting properties and so forth. So this description of the five elements, Panchabhuta, is rather outmoded. But actually, if you look at that description in the Vedic literature, you will see that it has features which never made it to Greece or Europe. Specifically, it's described that the earth, air, fire, water, and so forth correspond to objects of sensation, which are sort of psychological realities. And these in turn correspond to modes of perception and organs of perception. For example, ether is connected with sound, and sound in turn is connected with the sense of hearing. So in the manifestation of the elements, in this potential phase of creation, first sound is manifested before even ether exists. Today we tend to think of sound as a vibration that passes through gross matter. But the Vedic sound, that's an entirely different conception. One has to simply throw out the idea of sound as, in the conditioned state, has to be interfaced with the material energy. So some kind of apparatus is needed for that. So apparently this is created first. This whole apparatus is put together on a potential level before there are any living entities there. So this is what is being described in the creation, when the creation of the material universe is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And these elements of ether, air, fire, water, and earth really are related to modes of sensation.
rather than simply being sort of crude ideas of the gross physical elements. So the actual Vedic account is referring to something quite sophisticated. It's not a primitive account by any means, and it's referring to an area in which science thus far has not made any advancement. Because in fact, the scientists cannot understand how consciousness relates with matter. In fact, when the modern scientific development took place, the very first thing that happened was that the possibility of understanding consciousness was eliminated. Because modern science is based on essentially applying mathematics to nature, that is, describing everything in terms of numbers or in terms of geometry with points and lines and so forth. So as soon as that approach was adopted to understanding nature, it became impossible to understand consciousness, because in fact you can't understand consciousness in those terms. So this took place in the time of Galileo and then Descartes and so forth. And Descartes tried initially to create a sort of dual picture in which he had consciousness existing on the one hand and matter described by geometry on the other hand. But he couldn't relate the two things to one another. And so this created a dilemma which was never resolved. And finally the philosophers said, well, look, this business of consciousness is just something we shouldn't even try to talk about. We may as well forget about it. Let's just talk about gross matter. And so ever since that time, that's been the predominant trend in science, almost universal trend. One simply talks about gross matter. So there's no understanding in modern science of how you relate sensation and conscious awareness with these material elements. That's simply not there. But in the Vedic description of the elements, that's sort of the fundamental starting point. Everything is described in terms of the relation between the gross manifestations and the states of consciousness and the apparatus for perception and so forth. So I'll just describe also this statement Srila Prabhupada made about seeds. He says here, one should not expect the Lord to create like a blacksmith with a hammer and other instruments. The Lord creates by his potencies. He has his multifarious potencies, parasya saktir vividaiva shruyate. Just as the small seed of a banyan fruit has the potency to create a big banyan tree, the Lord disseminates all varieties of seeds by his potential brahmajyoti, svarochisha. And the seeds are made to develop by the watering process of persons like Brahma. Brahma cannot create the seeds, but he can manifest the seed into a tree, just as a gardener helps plants and orchards grow by the watering process. So the idea is that these potential manifestations are first created by Krishna through the agency of Svarochisha, his personal effulgence. And they exist in a potential form, so they're not really manifest. But then Brahma is endowed with the power to cause these seeds to begin manifesting. So the analogy of a seed is quite appropriate, because in a seed there's also something in potential form. Just like a banyan tree potentially is there within this tiny little seed, but if you plant it in the appropriate situation, then the whole tree will grow in due course of time. So similarly, Brahma is like the gardener, and he's given these seeds through the action of Lord Krishna, and then he plants them within the universe. And they then develop. And he doesn't even understand how it happens. Just as a human gardener, if he plants a seed for tomato, and a tomato plant comes up, he doesn't know how it's happening. But he does have some knowledge of how you should water it and fertilize it and so forth so that it can grow properly. So that's the role of Brahma. So, what time is it? Okay, I'll stop there. Are there any comments, questions? Yeah?
If the followers of Sankaracharya are compounding, Krishna is actually the personification of the mode of goodness in a pure form, how it seems like a contradiction to me. How can you be the personification of the material world and be in a pure form at the same time?
Well, they say he's not in a pure form. He's just the purest thing around, but still not pure. This is their position. So, yeah, which is a bit on the blasphemous side. Yeah? I suspect it's a matter of how potential you want to get. Because since the Brahma Jyoti is Krishna's effulgence and Krishna always is endowed with all powers.
But the thing is, the Brahma Jyoti manifests in the spiritual world also, even in the material world.
Yeah, so sometimes, yeah, it's like an instrument. Srila Prabhupada says that you couldn't expect Krishna to create with a hammer and tongs. So if you have a hammer and tongs, say you're a blacksmith, sometimes you may not be making horseshoes, and other times you may be doing it. So, when you're not making horseshoes, the hammer and tongs will simply have nothing about them that has anything to do with the horseshoes. But when you are...
Then, if you say, the scripture says, that the Brahma Jyoti is the medium through which the potentiality can be manifested by force.
That's the impression I have reading this description. The impression I get is that this Brahma Jyoti is sort of like an instrument through which Krishna is present everywhere, and so when he wants, he can just manifest things through that. That's sort of the impression I get from this. Yeah, that's correct, I think. We even have examples. For example, Kardama Muni manifested by his yogic powers a flying city, completely equipped with all amenities and so forth. And it's described there that he was surprised himself to see it happen. And we have that experience also, because the only difference between our powers and mystic powers is that since we have our powers, we take it for granted that we have them. But our powers are also very mysterious. That is, the things we can do. How is it that we can talk, for example? If you stop to think of it, that's an amazing thing. You know, you want to say something, and all these words come out arranged in a certain order and so forth. And even if I could figure out how it works, I couldn't figure that out fast enough to keep up with the necessary flow of words. So, and actually I don't know how it works.
And another question is that since the base conception is that connected with the sense, this doesn't then negate the existence of the different elements of what it doesn't negate the periodic chart.
Oh, it doesn't negate that.
So all of those different things that can be there, then I can just break down those. Mm-hmm. Of course, we know that there's lots of different kinds of air.
Yeah, like there are further subdivisions. Of course, another thing is the Bhagavatam is just giving a very general account. It's not giving technical details about different types of elements and so on. But indeed, there are, 10 different airs within the body. So those are 10 different types of air, and so on. So the various elements, material elements, represent different specific subdivisions that then become manifested. And this may not be described in detail, but that's there.
So then you could say that earth would mean something also like carbon, and water would mean something like liquid something.
Well, you see, that's what I think is precisely what these terms don't mean. Obviously, earth has something to do with things that are solid, and water has to do with liquids and so on. That's true enough. But what these terms really refer to are certain ways of perceiving. Earth is endowed with the property of odor and is connected with a sense of smell, which is not present in water, for example. Water is associated with the sense of taste and the sense of touch and the sense of form or vision and the sense of hearing, but not with the sense of smell. Then fire is there. When you go to fire, you eliminate taste, and it's connected with sense of vision, the sense of touch, and the sense of hearing. And then so forth. When you go to air, then you eliminate vision from those three. Ether is connected with the sense of hearing, but not the other senses, and so on. So somehow, what these things really are is something connected with these modes of perception and the senses. The specific manifestations of carbon and so on, I think that's on a more detailed level that develops from these broader categories. And also, the elements we're familiar with, just like water, Srila Prabhupada points out that none of these elements are pure. They're always mixed in with other things. So even pure water is not the real pure water. That is, it's a mixture of water and earth and air and so forth. There's just a predomination of certain elements over other elements. This is something you have to consider when discussing, say, modern chemistry, because they will say, well, water is a combination of hydrogen and oxygen. You know, you can have a glass of water, put two electrodes in it, and invert test tubes above the electrodes, and put a current through that with a battery. They do that in high school chemistry classes. And above, I forget which it is, the anode or the cathode, you get oxygen, and above the other one you get hydrogen. So then you can combine them and get water again. So they'll say, well, it seems that water then is a product of two kinds of air. All right. And fire. But that's well and good, but there's more to it than that. There's this, somehow the question of how the senses come in, which is a very important aspect of the whole thing.
So mostly the modern conception is just separating.
Well, in the modern conception, the scientists they want to reduce these elements down, first of all, to atoms. Then they reduce the atoms down to electrons, protons, and neutrons, and so on. And now they want to reduce the protons down to quarks. And then they have a whole host of other things they discovered, mesons, and this, that, and the other thing. And their idea is to find the ultimate little particles and say, okay, everything is made up of these little particles, and there are just so and so many of them, and they're interacting, spinning around one another in some way. And that's what everything is. That's reality. But they're leaving out other important aspects of the whole thing. Namely, this whole element of consciousness is a glaring omission from their picture of things. So, and that's a whole subject, of course, obviously. But, we should chant japa now. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.